Hi, everybody. This is Sharon Christofiak, and I'm hosting today's web training class with Denise Murphy, who is well known to many of us. She's currently employed at the Mainline Health System, and her new job description is she's Vice President of Quality. You may have known her as the APIC President in 2007, and she's also the former Vice President, Chief Safety Officer, and Quality Officer from Barnes Jewish BJC in St. Louis, Missouri. And I know Denise has traveled extensively and probably spoken to various chapters and groups, so you may be very familiar with her. You may also be familiar with a lot of her work. She has been a major force in process improvement throughout the United States and Canada. And without any further ado, I'd like to turn it over to Denise, because it looks like from her slides, this is going to be an exciting teleclass. Denise, want to get started?
Yes, thank you. And thank you, everyone, for signing on today. Can everybody, well, I'm asking, can everybody hear me? But, of course, you're muted, so it would probably take too much time. But if somebody can figure out how to signal Sharon if you're having trouble, then that would be great. I'm going to talk today about using performance improvement tools and methods and approaches to improve patient outcomes, and share with you, with the absolute permission of Barnes Jewish Hospital, some of the work that we did there that focused on the experience of the patient with essential line. And you notice that I'm intentionally not saying that we were focused on the reduction or even the elimination of catheter associated bloodstream infections or central line associated bloodstream infections, but instead we really, really use performance improvement tools and methods to map out and understand the entire experience of the patient and their team when a central line is needed for the care of that patient. So I did want to mention that I have their approval to share this information with you. So performance improvement, you know, it's designing or redesigning or choosing which interventions must we aim at a particular project or initiative or population of people in order to change their behaviors or to change a process or a system that is going to actually involve the change of behaviors, possibly the change in equipment or the change in roles and responsibilities and so on. Performance improvement is just the systematic process of really discovering and analyzing where there are gaps in human performance and then how do we address those for better performance in the future. How do we design and develop cost-effective and ethically justifiable interventions to close any gaps in performance and then roll out change or implement interventions throughout an organization? And then the last piece of any comprehensive PI program is evaluating the financial and the non-financial results. So I'm going to breeze through the tools since this is not actually just a course in Lean Six Sigma. It's really about how we apply it in healthcare. I'm going to have some slides that have lots of information about the Lean techniques, and we'll hit on what I think are the key ones that will help you understand how we use these to change the experience of the patient with a central line and their team, but rather won't read every part of a slide, and we'll let you use some of these PI reference materials for your further information in the future. So is it an art or science? Well, you know, who really knows, but hopefully if it's well done, it's a little bit of both, and not just includes the use of tools and some methods, the use of statistics, and actually in a sophisticated project, there'd be people that actually do some mathematical modeling. And then whether or not there's art and science behind this stuff is always very debated, because there is what's called reliability science, and that is how we build or engineer reliability into anything that we're designing or changing. You can say that Six Sigma, depending very much on statistics and math and the reduction of variation, and then calculating out the sigma effect on that is rather mathematical, so you could call that a science. And the art that I won't get into today, but I feel very passionate about, is one's ability to influence and persuade and actually drive change through an organization. So some of the things that you're probably familiar with and that your organizations probably fit somewhere, even if just broadly, into these categories of PDCA or PDSA, that Plan, Do, Check, Act, or Plan, Do, Study, Act, that the Joint Commission has used for years. Now you can even find on the Joint Commission's website some hybrid of DMAIC, which is what Six Sigma is built on, and Six Sigma has Lean also been started in industry, in the automotive industry, in the electronics industry. But that stands for Define, Measure, Analyze, Improve, and Control. The Toyota Production Systems, or TPS, Lean Engineering is really aimed at getting the waste out, and I find that the frontline staff, more than anything, embraces Lean, because when you see some of the methods that are used in Lean Engineering, you'll understand why these are intuitive, or surely at least not intimidating to frontline staff. Lean Six Sigma is a hybrid. So it's sort of Lean Engineering principles built on the DMAIC, or the Define, Measure, Analyze, Improve, and Control framework. And that's what a lot of organizations are doing. The way we describe it here in this organization that I'm currently working is that we want to do Lean Engineering because we know that cutting the waste out will fix about 80% of our problems in healthcare in terms of processes and systems that we're building to try and reliably put out the same outcome each time. And then Six Sigma is more used for advanced problem solving. This is the use of Minitab, which is a statistical software package, and showing analysis of variance and really showing teams where is the variation in this process, and it aims you for where you have to put the most effort. GE, which has been a Six Sigma company for many years, has described something called GE's Express Workout. And this was fun. I toyed with this a bit at Barnes Jewish in terms of trying to get our huge Patient Safety and Quality Committee into actually doing some work and not showing up and just sitting in and having some snacks and listening to a handful of people that did all the work in the committee. I started making some of those meetings a couple of hours long, and we would actually use the GE workout methodology for addressing things like isolation compliance. And we'd break out into teams where they'd address isolation compliance when in the med-surg unit, in the ICU, on oncology units, or in the OR. So we'd kick off all on the same page about the knowledge about what we were supposed to be addressing, and that is isolation, contact isolation, and how we comply or don't, which was the problem. And then we would use some tools to get teams really digging down and addressing the barriers and coming up with better ways in their particular units to ensure isolation compliance. And then at the end of that, there's like a town hall meeting where administration has to go thumbs up or thumbs down on whether or not a particular change is something they're willing to invest in. And then you have report backs in 30, 60, 90, and 120 days. And by then, something should be newly designed. So many of these things are really used. And there's consulting firms that have built incredible businesses around all of these things, as you can imagine. But you can't really use any of these PI frameworks without change management. So the improvement work is really getting much more analytical and much more based on the scientific and mathematical principles, but something that, if you're an infection preventionist, should come to you fairly naturally once you're exposed. And at Barnes Jewish Hospital, my former job, I actually had many of the infection preventionists become Six Sigma black belts and get on Lean teams so that they could get some Lean training. And they would just tackle these ICUs with these new PI approaches, because what they were doing was they were taking their content expertise, infection prevention and control, and then they were building upon them with facilitation expertise so that they could, you know, really facilitate change and then bring all the other experts around the table that were needed. If we have time at the end, I have a couple of great books that I'll share the authors with you. GE Workout is the name of a book that I use, and Execution is another one that really focuses more on implementation. But at the end, I'll try and get this list to you in case you should have some further interest in this. On to the next slide around change management. This is the practice of really administering changes with the help of some tested models and techniques in order to avoid new errors and to maximize the impact of change on an organization and its individuals. So how many times have you seen a team of folks fix one problem and yet create a new one? And I think that's what change management largely focuses on. And it also brings in a lot of systems thinking to understand the actual implications of making a change in one area and then predicting where that change is going to have an impact on other things that possibly you don't want changed. Change management really looks at three distinct components. It looks at how individuals in an organization will adapt to change. Some of this is prediction. Some of this is observation as you go through change. And some of this is what I call, you know, damage control or cleanup after you've gone through a change and you see that, you know, there are some actual negative aspects of it that you have to turn around and readdress. Controlling change, meaning controlling the pace of change and sort of not overwhelming people. We talk a lot about, are we going to do this in steps or are we going to come out with the big bang approach? We're implementing CPOE here at Mainline Health System, and the issue here is we did not decide to go with the big bang approach and are rolling it out unit by unit, hospital by hospital. And what we're finding is that the trying to integrate the CPOE and electronic methodology of ordering with all the paper ordering, sometimes you have people on one unit and maybe the residents are advanced in CPOE but the attendings are not. And so, you know, either way, it's not that easy. If you go the big bang approach, you try and throw everybody into change at once. It sometimes will shut down a unit or an organization because it's so so huge. So controlling the change and then finally affecting change. So what are those ways that we have to influence people to adopt change, and then how do we study change after and during its implementation so that we know if, in fact, it's been effective in producing the outcome we hoped for. So proactive approach in dealing with change is really at the core of all three of these aspects. On the next slide where you see a little, almost looks like a bullseye, it's just a visual that I got from a change management toolbook around stating that it is meant to manage the people side of the change processes to achieve expected outcomes and then to realize the change effectively. So change management looks at really three layers. It looks at first the impact of change on an individual, next the impact of change on their team. So a team could be no more than a clinician and their patient, or it could be an entire unit of oncology care providers or emergency room department healthcare workers. And then, of course, around the larger organization. So again, when you change a lot of things in the ED, that change is going to roll out to other areas. Going on to the next slide, I can't help but have to mention human factors engineering. Human factors engineering is based on the sciences of both physics and ergonomics, the study of people essentially in their workplace with their tools. And it looks at how man or woman with their tools in the system or environment in which they live or work, all of those interactions and interfaces. So it is a multifaceted discipline. I've learned a lot about this from Carla Alvarado, who has spent her life in our profession and then has become actually a doctor of human factors engineering, and constantly how we apply this to the field of infection prevention and control is very interesting research. But it really applies to the design and the work that goes on in complex systems. And surely healthcare, whether you look at an entire country's system, whether you look at a full organization, whether you take it down to the unit level or then within a few teams, you know, or processes within a unit. Certainly, all of the interactions make us a complex system. So it provides the opportunity to really look at these interfaces to optimize humans' performance, especially around the tools and equipment that they need in order to operate, and then it makes some important economical decisions. So I just next slide is just a fun picture that Laurie Wolf took for us. She's a human factors engineer that I actually hired into the patient safety and quality program. She was the manager of ergonomics for our health system and was very happy to come over and be much closer to the front line in working as a human factors engineer on our teams. And so she has a ton of pictures that would be fun to share with you, all of them. But this one is so common, isn't it? And I put the question there, is it good or poor design? As we look at the whole concept of cleaning hands and then drying them with a towel, and then as we're disposing of them, you know, we're in the trash, which really isn't limited often to just the clean towels from newly washed hands, but could have a baby's diaper or a tissue that's been newly sneezed or blown into. So, you know, human factors engineers walk around and just constantly observe the design of everyday things, which is another wonderful book, actually, The Design of Everyday Things. And that's really very much about human factors. So the implementation science or art of execution helps us maintain focus on the vital few, develop some tracking systems that facilitate problem solving, and, you know, one of the things, and then set up some formal reviews. And, you know, one of the things that I feel passionate about is if a team is out there dangling in the organization and they're not connected to any group, whether it's an important and influential committee, an important group of executive leaders, or certainly with an executive sponsor that they have to do their sort of milestone reviews to, then it doesn't really drive the work that quickly. People need a deadline because they have their day job to go back to when they finish doing some committee work or extra work, which most people see it. And one of my goals is to help people see that this is the way we need to do things, is in a constant mode of PI. But I think conducting drill downs, reporting out routinely to executives is so important, so that if you're involved in the execution or implementation of performance improvement work, to make sure you schedule those important reviews and that people know they're very clear about their roles and timelines and responsibilities, then I think you have a better chance of succeeding. And I'm going to jump over this next slide, which is just a couple of quotes that I love from Harvard Business Review about, you know, in the end, no matter how great your tools and methods are for anything, if you don't have the right people in the right roles, then you do have to look at that first. But if you do, then you should go out and look beyond that to your resources, like the tools and methods that you're trying to use. So going on, I've added a few key messages for infection preventionists, and because I could storytell all afternoon and don't want to run out of time to get to some of the key slides, I'm going to skip over this. But I think that what this says in a nutshell to me is that everyone is looking to us for better programs of prevention, and there has never been a better time to be in this field. Or depending on your perspective, there's never been a worse time, because it's certainly busier than any of us has ever been. And if we don't start to expand our tool set and start to learn how to facilitate change more quickly, I don't think we're going to really survive in this environment. So I'm going to talk in the next several slides about systems. And again, I'm going to go over these really quickly so that I can get to the meat of the work we did at Barnes Jewish applying systems thinking and the tools of lean to the care of patients. But I really do think, and this is sort of the underpinning of any patient safety program, is that we have to learn to be system thinkers. And I like to think about infection prevention actually as our own little system that we hopefully can be the masters of, and try and get the people that we're trying to get to comply with infection prevention measures to understand that this is a system, and that you're part of something bigger, you know, and this is tough with a very task-driven workforce. And it's not just nurses. It is our residents that are coming out of training programs. It is our laboratorians. People's task list is so long that to get them to step back and understand their role in the larger system is not always easy. So I have a definition of a system here. The basics are it's an integrated collection of lots of things, facilities, parts, equipment, materials, blah, 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 designed to actually achieve some purpose or function, and all the components of the system must be organized as a whole in order to achieve that purpose or function. The next slide is the components of all systems. They all have interaction and interfacing of elements and people, equipment, and cultures and policies and all of that. And most systems have some type of conversion process. So there's input on one end, output on the other, and some process of conversion that occurs in between, and that's really where we get most of our information from. Systems have structure, input, outputs. They operate in an environment. They have attributes and characteristics, and systems must be managed. They must have change agents and decision makers. So in infection prevention and control, you'd probably agree with me that we do have an infection prevention system that we are largely responsible for. The next slide is from a book, Human Factors in Engineering and Design, by McCormick and Sanders. And I just threw this up there with some easy-to-understand information for those of us that work in a clinical setting. So you see the information going in, you see the output on the other end, and over top of every system is some level of information storage. Ideally in healthcare, to be an electronic medical record. Wouldn't it be great if we were all there? And I hope our president can get us there. But as you start with the input in any system, there's a sensing function. There's information processing, and then there's actions and functions that have to occur in order to produce any output that we might want. So for the patient needing to have INO monitored, we somehow receive that information from an order, either verbal or written. We process that information, make decisions on how to monitor routinely INO through the insertion of a Foley catheter, and then have to do things like after the insertion, we have maintenance of a closed urinary catheter system, recording of INO, and so on. And that information, that record of INO, is going to really produce some output that will be used to make the next treatment decisions, and that in a system you'd call it the throughput. How output then is that information is processed, and it gives you information to either continue with the same input or to change what you're doing on the front end. The next slide is the complex adaptive system, and this is really something that was shared with me by Pascal Carrion and Carla Alvarado from University of Wisconsin. This is what they use in their System Engineering Initiative for Patient Safety to describe how different a complex adaptive system really looks from Donna Badian's, which is across the top, where we have sort of the structure. Here we have people lined up like they're our work system, and then next you have the process, like patients undergoing procedures, and then you have an outcome, which hopefully is a patient that leaves our organizations with no adverse events and with the outcome they expected. But if you look down below, they've redesigned this to show this more as it's not linear, it's very interactive. In that first big box where you have tools, technology, and training interacting with people, tasks, tools, the environment, and then up in that right-hand corner is the organizational culture and how the organization does their work, how they handle information, how they support or empower their frontline staff, and so on. So you have all that interaction going on, and the interaction really results in patient care and other types of processes that result in both patient and employee outcomes. But this does make it a much more complex model than a simple structure, process, and outcome, because what we do most days is far from linear. So if people aren't totally predictable, and we know that about humans, on the next slide, what can we build in to make processes more reliable and therefore outcomes more reliable? I always start any PI work with the challenge when I kick off a team. I say, I'm going to ask you, without even knowing what your recommendations will be in the end for either a redesign of new processes or changing of old processes, but I'm going to ask you wherever possible to simplify, standardize, and automate. And those are the first three critical aspects of making processes more reliable. And then you build in the redundancies and your recovery strategies, your visual cues that help people see at a distance exactly what has to happen. So just in systems thinking, to think about a busy person running across the unit that has never been in a patient's room before, but what's going to give them the cue to get ready to start complying with isolation precautions from several feet away? So are our signs really good visual cues? One of our innovative teams around VAP came up with the idea that if they put big red tape behind a patient's bed, then you could see without having to do any measurement at all if the bed was high enough to prevent aspiration. So these are the kind of things that when you're system thinking, you're getting away from that, well, let's just do more education and training, but then you're getting down to using a little bit more of engineering principles. And, of course, having people in the right roles with clear responsibilities outlined for them, empowering them to do their job in a supportive culture is really pretty much the things that are needed. So at Barnes Jewish, we decided to use some lean engineering principles aligned with some Six Sigma problem solving to map out, analyze, redesign, and hopefully sustain. And I'm not there anymore, but I check in all the time with the folks at Barnes Jewish to see how able are they to sustain some of the new processes they designed. And they have assured me as recently as last week that some great things are still happening from this value stream analysis that we did, with the end result, hopefully, of an almost, if possible, defect-free experience for the patient and their team, and hopefully with the outcome of eliminating the risk for CLABSI. So tools and methods, lean is really designed to cut out the waste, and in the diagram I show you, there's all these different things. There's visual cues or controls, there's error proofing, creation of standard work so that everybody everywhere is doing it the same way. Six Sigma, on the other hand, is another tool that is designed to reduce variation. So you're really building in reliability now after you've cut out the waste so that everybody is doing the same way. Same thing, the same way all the time. So the lean appendix is rather lengthy, and I'm not going to read all of the descriptions, but go through this quickly so I can get into the work that we've done. The principles that you talk about often are value and value streaming, or actually mapping out everything that goes into the experience that a customer has. All the steps, actions, and processes that actually deliver what they believe are valuable. And then you have the flow, and flow challenges us to reorganize our value stream to be continuous. And that is the only way to minimal waste, is that we don't have a lot of excess, we don't have a lot of delays. Pull means that it challenges us to respond on demand to things. And boy, as a nurse, I can so, if every time I see this, do you know what I think of? Stuffing my pockets with extra syringes, extra whatever, Band-Aids, packing the room with extra linen. We are pack rats. We are hoarders in healthcare. And so this really goes against the grain of how we operate. And yet in manufacturing, they could never stock up that kind of inventory. In the end, it's waste, especially if a patient ends up on isolation. And then to go for defect-free processes at the lowest cost possible. So that in a nutshell is what lean engineering is about. And then the basic elements of lean are mapping out flow and studying it, 5S-ing, which I'll talk to you about more in a minute, visual management, or putting visual signals or cues up to really promote quick but very effective communication, the whole idea of pull, one by one, standard work, and that is identifying the best practices and then building them in so that everybody is doing them and they're almost not able to choose how they do it because it's so built in to a process, and hopefully always aiming for zero defects. Next slide is, what is the value stream analysis process? Well, it's really just a way of using the Lean tools to analyze your process, prescribe a plan with timelines and assignments for transforming it, and then achieving breakthrough results. The deliverables of a value stream analysis, which is about a 4 or 4.5 day event, usually ending with a report out to a large group of decision makers, what you come away with are 3 value stream maps. So when you hear process mapping, that's the same thing, that's what we're talking about. But here you'd come out with 3 process maps. One that gave you a clear picture of how it happens today, that's your current state map. Your ideal state, where you go next, and boy, isn't this work as a facilitator to get people to draw something in the ideal, because we are so predisposed to looking at resources, and you know, we know we won't get FTEs for this, and we know we won't get the money for that, or you know, we get so mired in the barriers. But the work of the facilitator here is to get people envisioning the ideal state, and then the future state is, what can we do to get to the ideal state in the next 6 to 12 months? So it's almost like your ideal state is your long-term plan, knowing that a lot of this is truly ideal and you're aiming for perfection that you won't achieve. But your future state is a little more based in reality and something you believe you can accomplish with the right leadership support and the right design in about 6 to 12 months. You must come up with metrics. Any performance improvement program is going to fail if you don't have the metrics that almost on a daily basis somehow can show you how well you're doing. We too often look back at everything. We watch our outcome metrics that are sometimes several months old, and you know, that's not meaningful in driving change. But process metrics that we could take a trip out to a unit with an observation tool and an hour and really come back with some good information about how people are managing or complying with a process is very informative in these types of events. Then we come up with a detailed action plan. We break it down into 3 things. Can this work be done in a rapid improvement event? If you're really looking at Toyota Production Systems language, they would call this a Kaizen. Performance improvement projects can't be done as rapidly as a 5-day event, but it's something that we believe we can get done in a matter of weeks or months. And then what are the just do it? So the just do it are things like, how long has this been since, you know, we've had a decision on this? It's gone through 20 committees. It's come up 100 times. How are we going to get this done? You page the right administrator or group of administrators. This is why you really need leadership support for this kind of work. They, in real time, either come to the room where the value stream team is working, or you go to them and say, here is a decision we need immediately. Here's what we believe it will cost. Here's the return on investment. Can you make this decision? Or we are looking to change a role of responsibility. In order for our rapid, you know, to go out and test our rapid design, do we have your approval to just go ahead and make this change? That's what just do it's are about, and we're very uncomfortable in healthcare with getting into just do it's, right? We do everything by committee. So the next slide is the fundamental building block of Lean, and I'm not going to spend time on all of these. I think I've hit on a lot of them, but let me just mention when I talk about 5S what I'm including. 5S means that you go to a work area, you straighten, you sort, you shine or clean, you standardize, and then you build in a methodology for sustaining. And you'll see a little bit of how we 5S the supply closets all over Barnes Jewish Hospital, a 1,200-bed hospital that spans several city blocks in one day. Moving on to what is value and what is not, this is kind of a no-brainer. You know, value adding is any activity that really changes the material being worked on and it increases its value. And then an important question is, to whom? And we're always really challenged to address who is our customer in this. And unfortunately, sometimes we have many. And then what is non-value added? Any activity that takes time, material, or space, but it really doesn't physically change the material or the process that, you know, the treatment or the procedure or whatever to increase its value. Now, I have one thing to say about non-value added work. So our surveillance, This is not value added from a patient's perspective. They would not pay for that. So if you're admitted to the hospital today and somebody says, okay, it's going to cost you $75 extra for the infection prevention and control surveillance, most patients say, oh, no, thanks, I wouldn't pay for that. Would they pay for the experience of not having an infection? Absolutely. So again, it's looking at, you can't just start chopping away everything in healthcare the way you can in manufacturing by answering the question, would someone pay for this or not? And then finally, some regulatory things will not be value added, but they must be included in a process. So what do you do about that? You look at how efficiently you can get that done. So how quickly can we check the box on this, since it's not real value added, but we know it needs to happen? The operational wastes I cannot go through for the sake of time, but they are here for you, and after each one, I have provided an example that is healthcare related. So when you have a team looking at a value stream map, the next thing they're challenged to do after they've mapped out a process is look for the operational waste, looking for defects, overproduction, waiting or delays, the neglect of human talent, or the misuse of skills. And we call this leveling the work at the right level. So are the professionals doing too much clerical work? Are the clerical workers doing housekeeping work? And so on. To go on with those is transportation, inventory, motion, and excess processing. And then I'm going to jump through some questions that if you were a facilitator, you would really be asking if you were doing a value stream mapping. And then finally, again, I mentioned, you build your future state as if there were no barriers, because it is so important that you get the buy-in of leadership and that you've made the business case for why, and the most important aspect of the business case, of course, is the clinical implications of why a process or a system needs to be redesigned. And once you get their buy-in, you need to let them know that you're going to try to define a defect-free experience without building in the barriers of organizational constraints and equipment and so on, but then you'll deal with them later as we have to do the work to call out the barriers. Doing a gap analysis is just outlining the differences in where you are today against your future state, and really getting those outlined. And you'll see, I won't even have time to read all the gaps that we showed up at Barnes Jewish Hospital when we were trying to look at our current state of the experience of a patient with a central line versus the future state we wanted to get to. Okay, and then I kind of mentioned about action plans, and just, you know, you brainstorm your solutions, you sort your action plans into events, PI projects, and just do it's. And then you start to really add on timelines and then assign responsible parties. So I'm on the slide now that says central line insertion and care, value stream analysis, February 08. So this was a cast of thousands that included the most incredible people, all of our hospital epidemiologists. We actually invited Carla Alvarado, and she's there in the picture on the left, to come so that we would have, in addition to our on-site human factors engineer, someone with really deep experience in human factors. We have our nurse manager from the ICU. We have our patient care techs and our transporters. We have our nurse educators. We have staff from the ICU that had zero BSIs, because no one could inform us better than a unit who was able to get to zero. Some of our work was in finding out how did you do that. So as in any good PI project, at the beginning you lay out your scope. That's on the next slide. The scope for this was from the decision to insert a central venous line to the actual line removal. We did have to go off on the side to process map for PICC lines and dialysis catheters, and we did that before we actually launched the official value stream analysis. The reasons for action I'm not going to read, but these are important that you would outline these for your organization. What is the impact, first of all, on lives, and then secondly on the organization in terms of money and excess length of stay, which is probably the most important aspect of the business case that your CFO is interested in, is how many days are we unable to keep the flow going and use that bed. Identifying the opportunity. So if you're on that slide with me, this looks at over time from the year 2000, and you know, we have raw numbers up there, but the rates, you know, kept going down as we were able to collect better denominator data on our line days. But we actually saw a drastic increase. This is all of our ICUs. There were seven or eight ICUs involved. I'm sorry, there were six or seven ICUs. I say or seven because the stem cell transplant service we actually considered to be like an ICU. And then identify a current success to build on. So that last slide just showed that we were ready for the next step because we really significantly decreased infections, but we sure as heck did not get them down to zero. When we started the work in the late 90s, we were in the hundreds of bloodstream infections. So the work that we did between, you know, 1997 and 2000 was the traditional improvement work. It was the education and the training and the reminding and the changing of policies and so on. And now here we were in 2007 and 08 looking at, you know, what do we need to do to get from 64 BSIs to zero? Well, the first people we turned to was our cardiothoracic ICU, which is that next slide that shows you that by 2007, they were experiencing zero bloodstream infections, and they actually went 18 months before they had their first one. The same ICU had a great history in infection prevention. These were truly our champions. They went 24 months without a deep sternal wound infection. I'm going to jump over this initial state slide, but it's just really documenting where your initial state is against where you would really like to be. The next slide, again, says initial state, but you can see this is cut from a document or a form where we actually had people out on the units looking at the process steps and what was the compliance with each step of a process, the hand hygiene, the use of a sterile mask and gown and cap, whether CHG was used and then allowed to dry, whether they used our large drape, if the dressing was dated and sterile field maintained, and so on. And you can see that after all of the hard work that went on in this place for years, we still did not have 100% compliance with all of the steps in the bundle, if you will, for the appropriate insertion and dressing of a central line. The next slide is about our solution approach for our events. We did some really fun things. One of the things we did was called a Gemba walk. That means we actually went out to the unit and we observed. One team observed the insertion of a central line, while another team actually went out and observed a dressing change. And we had collection tools with us where we could really look at where are the barriers in these processes or where don't these processes really lend to an excellent outcome. We did our process mapping, and you can see some pictures of the team there doing that. The lady in the red jacket was the manager of the vascular access team. And that we had just gone through a huge reduction in vascular access team staffing to the point where it was cut down to a bare minimum, and they were only available to do PICC lines. So she was surely very invested in this process to see what we would learn. Our solution approach included the voice of the customer. We actually, before the event, we actually went out and three or four of us met with the residents who inserted many of the lines. We went to vascular interventional radiology, anesthesia. We spoke to attendings that inserted lines. We included nurses that assisted with line insertion and took care of the dressings, and we spoke to the patients. We identified the eight wastes. We did some affinity diagramming and did some, you know, flow cell work, where could we 5S, and some of the things that I showed you in that flow cell from many slides ahead. Going on to our current state process map, what's important to see here is that we realize that when you map out this experience, you have to divide it into components and sections. So the first group of steps or our first process is the decision to insert. Our next process was preparation for insertion, then the actual insertion of a central venous catheter, the maintenance, and then the last step of our process was the discontinuation. And you can see that there were really many, many steps in this process. And the next slide is just a larger blow-up of that current state so that you can see this is the result of that work of mapping out the current state for each of these steps. The future state, of course, was to eliminate CLABSIs, but to have greater than 95% compliance with our insertion and dressing change recommendations, and then also to evaluate and identify any other complications related to the insertion of a central line other than infection. Again, thinking in a systems manner, you can't fix one thing and break something else, so we wanted to make sure that anything we were designing was not going to create pneumothorax or any other additional problems. Going from the current state to the future state, without going and reading each of these steps, you can see on the next slide that, you know, we were able to reduce the steps by 53%. So already you can see that going through this process, if you didn't go any further, has got to create a more reliable experience because of the reduction in all of the steps in the waste. Every step is an opportunity for something to go wrong. Next slide gets into our gap analysis. There's many points here, so I have to pick and choose a few of them. I'll start with some of the things that were most compelling, I thought, to deal with. We learned that RNs coming out of nursing school lacked the competency with peripheral sticks. Therefore, that led to a higher utilization of central lines, which led to a higher population at risk. We believed if we could address that gap, we would, of course, have fewer central lines and then fewer bloodstream infections. Of course, the lack of dedicated vascular access experts was also leading to health staff being called and putting in more central lines, especially lines outside of our ICU. We did not have standard algorithms or checklists for, we did in the ICU have our central line checklist and our kit and our cart, but out on the units where much of this work was being done, we did not have the same standard of care as we had in the ICUs. We didn't have enough staff to assist the providers with insertion, and then the supplies and equipment were not available as needed at the point of care. The next slide goes on with our gap analysis, and I'm going to jump through this and start to get to some of the fixes. So that just kind of goes on. Our first thing was a Just Do It. We're part of a large health system. We had been for many, many months having the discussion about full drapes being available in every single central line kit at every point of care where central lines were being inserted. And this was just one of these system bureaucratic holdups, and we got on the phone and said, we are in the middle of our value stream analysis. Our entire leadership is behind this decision. We are behind whatever cost we might incur for our portion of this change across BJC Healthcare. We need this done by the end of the week, and we were able to get approval for that. That's why you have executives as sponsors and part of these events. The next was our first performance improvement project, which was the varying staff skill levels in people that were placing peripheral IVs. The metric at the bottom under our future state is decreased CVCs. And, of course, our future state was increasing the staff level of competencies in first determining what type of line was needed and then in actually placing the central lines. If you look at the central line utilization ratio in the next two slides, wow, this was telling. And we put this together during the event with information that was available in the Infection Prevention and Control Department and to some degree in the Vascular Access Department. But we were able to show that at the end of the year of 2007, when the cuts to the vascular access team were made, we were able to show administration the drastic impact this had on the increase of central line utilization. This was for our medicine wards, and the next slide shows the jump in the utilization of our surgical wards. So the next performance improvement project was to address the lack of standardized educational materials for patients undergoing central lines, because during our Voice of the Customer, patients were telling us, well, when we asked them about central lines, they'd say things like, we don't really even know we have one. What is a central line? And sure enough, they had an IJ in, but they, you know, they were probably told about that, or else it was put in the OR, and they were told very little about it when they got delivered back to an ICU. So we put our education team on creating materials for patients and their families. The next rapid improvement event I'm sorry, the first rapid improvement event, those other ones were PI projects or just do it. Our first rapid improvement event was to address the fact that there was no standardized process for determining when to insert or when to remove a central line. The next one, rapid improvement event number two, was set up to address the lack of standard work. So we wanted for everyone involved in the preparation, insertion, care, removal, and documentation of a central line to be doing exactly the same thing across 100 units at Barnes Jewish Hospital with, 2,000 medical staff and 800 residents. So I don't have time to read through the initial state and the future state, but you can see that we were not looking for anything real out of the ordinary. We were looking for insertion checklists everywhere, standardized electronic documentation everywhere, visual cues to alert staff about when it was time to do a dressing change or so on. And an important thing we wanted to do was build in some empowerment of the staff so that if anyone saw someone not complying with our safety steps for line insertion or maintenance would be able to stop the line. We wanted to build in some mistake proofing at each critical step and then to have 95% compliance with our insertion process and our checklist. Rapid improvement events three and four were to address the lack of standard work. We wanted supplies and equipment in the version of kits and carts the same everywhere in the hospital, not just in our ICUs, and available at the point of care so that our metric would be 100% standardization and availability of our kits and carts wherever a central line was to be inserted. Our last rapid improvement event was a tough one. We wanted a vascular access command center where we would have a group of experts coordinating what was the best line, if someone needed help. So it's kind of like a consultation center. If there were decision issues that you could call a group of professionals to help you with decision on what type of line, so it would involve, a lot of use by the house staff especially, that there would be people that were experts and did training on best practice or could come to a site and help with a peripheral line insertion if the IV, instead of having to go right to the next step, which might be a PICC line. And we hope through doing this we would decrease our CVC utilization. So moving on, and I know I only have a few minutes, so talk about rapid. I'm going to go through some of the really fun things that we did. I'm going to jump by the scope and the reasons for action and our initial state, except to say about the initial state, look at the red dots. And this is actually how you mark what is a value-added step or a non-value-added step. And then every time you identify a value-added step, this is on the one of the initial state slides that has a picture on it, you can really focus in on asking the questions, can we get rid of this step? What do we have to change to make this step more efficient and effective? And can we check this step a different way and not put so much resource to it? So our initial state metrics are on the next slide that have metrics and baseline information. But one of the things I want to point out here is that that there were many central lines removed every week, and that the wait time to remove lines was sometimes up to 3 hours. Our communication process and the decision-making process to insert a line sometimes involved up to 22 steps. So the future state that we wanted, of course, was on the next slide, but let's jump to our gap analysis. And you can see where in the gap analysis you have to actually have all those post-its lined up in a very organized way that show you the different things that have to be addressed, your vascular access competency, your need for standard work and reduction of variation from floor to floor, your lack of transparency, that people even have a PICC line, for example, that needs to be involved in discharge planning, no cues for line maintenance, and then your lack of knowledge around line need, line care, and line removal. So the standard work, you can see on the next slide, we created an algorithm and assessment tool. We created a process to go through for line removal decision and actual removal of the line and for line maintenance. For transparency and visual cues, we got into the electronic documentation system and had IT on the team and clinical IS who helped us with this work. And then the communication plan was really around letting people know, here's what the vascular access team does, and here's what the procedure team is available to you to do. And that was the hospitalists along with some of the residents that were going through the hospitalist service rotation at the time. Our rapid improvement events addressed our variation in determining what was appropriate IV access needed for that particular patient. And the metric we used for that was to decrease the percent of peripheral IVs that had more than two attempts. And the next metric would be to increase the resident and RN comfort level with determining the type of vascular access. So the next thing is actually a tool. This was the tool we created around determining the necessity for a central line and being able to use a little bit of a quantitative method in being able to score. So, for example, you can see in the top half of this access determination grid or tool, it's the absolute indications for a CVC, so a trauma or a code, the need for TPN, chemotherapy, and so on. You go down a couple grids, and there's information about the anticipated duration, the type of infusions that the patient will get, and then other miscellaneous needs. And you can see a score attached to all of these things. And at the end of that, the result was, you see this at the bottom, if a patient had a score of 6 or less, they actually didn't even meet the criteria for a central line. If they had a score of 8 to 15, then they, you know, then they did. But in anything in between, there would be a real discussion with their primary physician. The next thing is an algorithm around urgency, and we built these things, both the tool for necessity, the algorithm that addressed the urgency for the need for the line, and this helped us decide whether or not really the patient would go to interventional radiology or where, you know, who would do it. And then the next one would be the decision to place and the type of line. You can see that that's an algorithm that asks a few key questions about the type of flow, whether it's long or short term, and then the options are underneath with some contraindications for each type of line outlined below. So the building of this electronically was done by clinical IS and became part of, if a physician made an placed an order for a central line, these tools would immediately pop up to help the medical staff with those decisions. And then we have the next slide, which is the central venous access curriculum. So I'm going to get, going to blow past the detail of the rapid improvement events just and get to some of the slides that show you some of the actual fixes that we did. The next slide that says define the line, this was a screensaver that was made because the staff kept saying, well, we don't know who to call for what. So we simply made screensavers during that week to put on all of the computer terminals across Barnes Jewish Hospital that showed people who to call for what type of line. The next rapid improvement event was talking about variation in the line removal process, and if you jump to the central line grid, it actually has pictures on it of the type of lines, who places them, and who removes them, and then what type of flush was used. So this really, again, was available electronically to in the little sort of electronic bundle that we put together for anyone that would be making a decision to access a central line. And it was posted in the units and in areas where there was a lot of training going on around central lines. So if you look at the next slide that says confirm state, I want to draw your attention to just the difference at the bottom in the number of steps of the decision-making process to insert the line. Went from 3 to 22. To really a post-experiment 4 to 5 steps. And then our target was to get to even 3 steps once we got our vascular access command center up and running. The next couple slides are really pictorials around PICC line removal, where we found there was a problem. We got that through both the voice of the customer and a little further digging. And the use of pictorials is important. It's beyond me why we found somebody with the worst hematoma I've ever seen in my life to use as a pictorial. But, you know, the bottom line is this stuff is done during a week-long Kaizen. So you get whatever you can, and then afterwards, when you find out if something's going to work, you can really refine it and make it into something that would become a long-term training tool. And then I'll blow past the completion plan, but if I had hours to do this, I would underscore how important it is to have a responsible party and a timeline. And then I'm going to wrap up with rapid improvement events number 3 and 4. The problem was standard work, and as a result of that, we wanted to come up with standardized central line supply kits, standardized procedure carts in all areas, our standardized insertion checklist for every unit, not just the ICU, the prep and documentation and so on. So just go to the next slide, which says confirmed state. I'm going to draw your attention down to time to gather supplies in the left-hand column. If you go over to that baseline, you can see that on a nursing division, it took up to 45 minutes to gather the equipment that was needed for a resident to start a central line. Post-experiment, it took 2.2 minutes. And the plan was not to have the resident or anybody restock, but we did for the sake of the experiment, and we still were under 10 minutes, or right around 10 minutes, even if we had them restock the cart with extra things. So our target was to get down to a routine of about 5 minutes and to have to gather 50% fewer items, and you can see that on the bottom line. The standardized central line kit was we went around to every supply closet. We did some 5S-ing. We labeled everything that had to do with a central line orange, starting with when you opened the door, you saw the orange sign on the door that showed where all of the equipment was and how much inventory there was. If you look at the next slide, you can see that the cart was also labeled orange, so people would know that was the central line cart, and every bin in the supply closet that included materials for the central lines was also labeled orange. And then we just looked at some transport options when we have to add an ultrasound, how will we move this thing around, and so on. And then jumping to what I found to be incredibly profound and tying back to the beginning of the talk when I mentioned human factors, we found out from the house staff that one of the greatest barriers and risks that they could identify was the constant interruptions, pagers, heads sticking in and out of the door flying open and closed the entire time they were trying to insert a line. So the team came up with, if the cart has to go to the room where the line's going to be inserted, we want to put a big orange stop sign on the cart. There'll always be one as part of inventory with every kit that will be placed on the door, and that the charge nurse, who we call on medicine, we called care traffic controllers. They wore these bright yellow vests, and they were very easily identifiable. So the resident could grab that person and hand over the pager just for the time when the line was being inserted. So, and restocking, of course, of the cart became part of the standard work. So I want to end with our return on investment, our then manager, Amy Richmond, for this area, who was the team leader for this. I was the sponsor, and then we had a infection preventionist who went on to get her black belt in Six Sigma, was our facilitator. But we were able to show that even after we purchased new catheters, new kits, standardized carts, added ultrasound machines, where you can see that's the biggest bulk of the cost. If we were able to just eliminate one-third of our central line associated bloodstream infections, we would be able to still realize the savings. After all the cost of everything, we'd still realize the savings of about $500,000. So the excitement around the report out on Friday, with all the executives in the room, directors, managers, nurse educators, you know, lots of key stakeholders used to show up for this. And, of course, this was after years of building PI in the organization. But it was really a fun event. The manager of the vascular access team came on like Vanna White, and she showed the new cart, and she showed the stop signs. And so we really made performance improvement work a lot of fun. So that last slide is just sort of you know, my idea of what an infection prevention system looks like, gathered around the patient and their team when there's a need for a central line, and all the things that we have to think about, including our tools, our equipment, our visual cues and the knowledge gaps, and then finally, what type of organizational culture do we have, and can we gain the leadership support to do this level of sophisticated work? So I'm going to end here. Of course, I've added my own, you know, push for, I'm always telling executive teams and trying to get the message out that infection prevention is our incredible leaders in every organization, and we as executives have to make sure that they have all the advanced skills that we need to move into what I hope is a better future. So thank you so much for your time and attention. I know we're right at cutoff, and I'd be happy to, if I could, take any questions or share anything through emails, and my email is at the end of this presentation. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Denise. This was fantastic. And I have to admit, we've been working on a lot of central line associated bacteremia issues. And you've given me some tremendous ideas that we haven't even touched on yet.
Good.
So I think the rest of the audience would agree this was a tremendous presentation. And we thank you very much. If you could hear us all applauding, you would appreciate it. So I will let you all have a great afternoon, and just as an update, the G20, the people have surrounded our building, so I'm getting off just in time, and everybody have a great day, and thanks again, Denise.
Thank you.
All right, bye now.